Kathy Hutchinson? Well, for those of you who don't know her, I'd like to tell you her story because I find it extraordinary. So, Kathy had a brainstem stroke at the age of 43, and she was in coma for 3 months. Then she woke up completely aware, but she was left paralyzed from the neck down and unable to speak. 15 years later, she was invited to participate in a research experiment. They implanted a sensor in her brain that, let's say, reads her thoughts, decodes the signals, and sends the information to her robotic arm. Using her thoughts, and only her thoughts, she's been able to pick up a bottle, bring it to her lips, take a sip of her coffee, and put the bottle back down. Just imagine what we could do for people who have lost their autonomy and need constant assistance. That is incredible. Okay, now, I'd like us all to imagine that today, tomorrow, the day after, human-machine interfaces, similar to this sensor, become available to everyone, even if we don't have any problems in particular. While we're imagining this possibility, let's have a specific example in mind. Let's imagine that your child, for instance, is passing a competitive entrance exam to a university that she or he really badly wants to get into, and that there are other students who have a sensor. People that have human-machine interfaces, but not your child. So what would they be able to do? For example, to think faster? To have a better memory, probably? What else can we imagine? Perhaps they'd be able to go online and search for information on the internet. Or perhaps, I don't know, like even maybe communicate among each other by telepathy with other people who also have interfaces. So, do you think that it would be fair for your child to compete with such people for that entrance exam? I don't think so. And that's a problem, considering that there are already a variety of gaps between people today, right? Gaps that are difficult to fit in. Education can help compensate, but with such an interface, the gap will be so phenomenal that it will be impossible to catch up, right? So what do we do now? Shall we let that happen or not? Well, I guess that there may be countries that will want to ban it. I don't know what you think about it, but every time we try to ban something, people who can afford it will always find a way to do it elsewhere. How else governments could react? Hypothetically, let's say that in France, the country where I come from, since our motto is freedom, equality, fraternity, since we're very egalitarian, perhaps a grant would be put in place so that everyone has an equitable access to it. To human machine interfaces. Well, if we were to do that, which definitely isn't granted because it's a very particular societal choice, right? Well, we agreed that it wouldn't be mandatory. That wouldn't make sense. So we would find ourselves with people who would be like us today and people who would be equipped with sensors. It would mean that people who are like us today would have a sort of handicap compared to people in the future. So, I don't know what you think about it, but I find it all very complex. Issues like this one, I can't say if I'm in favor or against it. I find it difficult to think in black and white. Because I see how it could help people like Kathy. But there are other consequences that I don't feel quite comfortable with. And yet, frequently, when we hear such debates in the media, the people who talk, who discuss those issues, they often have very clear-cut opinions. When two people are invited to debate, there's often one person who is for, in favor, and the other who's against, and, you know, people are confronting each other. But in reality, between for and against, there are 1,000 possible options. It's possible to have a nuanced opinion. But how do we go about it? I don't know about you, but when I reflect on the subject of emerging technologies, where there's a novel purpose that's presented, I'm always a little confused because it's still completely new. It's not easy to project oneself into all the possibilities that a new technology offers. So I often find myself making a choice between for or against, a very black and white choice. And a few months ago, whilst making a choice like that, I found myself interestingly in a situation where I realized that I was defending the same cause as people who had values that were the complete opposite of mine. And then I wondered, how did that happen? How could I be on the same side as people who stood for things that I didn't want to see happen for anything in the world? Well, it's precisely because I made a in favor or against kind of choice, a black and white one. Because I had chosen a side. I don't know about you, but when I form an opinion in general, I'll try to hear people's debates, read opinion pieces in the media, in newspapers. I'll hear their arguments, their pros and cons. There are some that speak to me, and others less so. People I find relatively convincing. And then I end up taking side, saying, okay, got it, I think I'm a pro. I'm in favor of that position. So now, let's talk about how I saw it regarding to universal income. That topic I was talking about where I ended up taking side of people who I wasn't sharing values with. So for me, as I saw it, universal income was an opportunity for everyone to not just work for money to put food on the table, but to do things that make sense to us as an individual. Usually only people who can afford it can choose jobs that make sense for them, where they can have an impact. But I believe that universal income could be an opportunity for everyone to put themselves in that position. And, you know, for each of us, it could be something different. It just means that we'd be spending time on things that make our lives worth living. To spend time on things that make us feel as though we have an impact on society. So, it was rather surprising when I discovered that in the Silicon Valley, universal income was a topic that people were also more or less in favor. Perhaps it was a bit of a caricature in my head, but I thought that universal income was a little like welfare or a subsidy. In France, we'd say socialist. And not something that was really in the more, let's say, liberal habits of Silicon Valley, more capitalistic. So, yeah, that surprised me a bit. And I did some research. And in fact, in Silicon Valley, universal income is a subject that is thoroughly analyzed. It's not a new topic at all. Like, even in France, there have been intellectuals who've been reflecting on this subject for a long time. But in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, it's a subject that's coming back on the forefront for one reason. Because job automation is coming, and it's coming at full force. I remember an Oxford study where perhaps they were more pessimistic than the others, but they're estimating that up to 47% of the American population could see their jobs automated within 15 years. Now, we're not projecting ourselves into, you know, the human-machine interfaces people could have in a long time from now. No, that's 15 years from now. 15, that's nothing. It will concern a great number of us, people who are still working. So in Silicon Valley, the universal income is seen as an unavoidable necessity. Yeah, an unavoidable necessity. In fact, it's a way to guarantee social peace and to ensure that consumers continue to consume. So I guess we'll agree that it's, quite frankly, what I thought it was. And I was pretty surprised that I was defending an idea that was potentially not at all in the same scope as what I had in mind. Because what I had in mind was that the universal income could let us choose not to work, could be a choice we'd make to enable us to get involved in things that make sense to us, maybe work less to get food on the table and instead spend some time doing things that matter for us. But in that scenario, where universal income is rather used to avoid revolutions, well, it has nothing to do with that at all. In fact, we'd find ourselves not working because we're no longer needed, because we've become useless or obsolete. It's not the same perspective at all. So what do? To avoid taking a bit of a hard line, only to realize that we're defending an opinion that's honestly not ours. Well, first, there's an essential question we need to ask ourselves. When we're listening to someone, in the media for instance, we need to determine that what the person is saying is because either the person knows it, or whether the person believes it, or if the person thinks so. And those are not the same things at all. Actually, there are two types of responses that can come from an outside source when it relates to a complex issue. There are answers that come from outside of us, like, for example, science. We know that the Earth isn't flat. It's round. There's no debate. We agree, right? There's no debate, apart from weirdos. It's scientific. It's the truth. There's nothing to be in favor or against. And often, when we listen to people in debates, there are people who make us think that when they talk, when they debate, that they know something. Especially when they're engineers or scientists, you get the feeling that they know. So we shouldn't question what they say, right? When in fact, even though they might have scientific backgrounds and we can totally rely on them for some topics, well, sometimes when they express their views, they're just saying things that they believe in or that they think. So what's the difference between the two? Well, believing comes more from an outside perspective. For instance, The first belief that comes to mind could be religious belief. But there's lots of beliefs. We are all bathed in beliefs without always realizing it. For instance, when you live in France, where I grew up, well, that's a particular culture. And then when you go abroad, you realize that there are things at home that seemed obvious to you that, you know, you find yourself a little surprised that things are done otherwise elsewhere. And then finally, you start questioning what always seemed obvious to you and, yeah, why not? You realize that, yeah, you never just thought about things that could be done another way and they're fine too. You also have beliefs that come from your family. You know, those things that are ingrained in us bit by bit over time, building even our characters without noticing it too much. And also, we belong to groups. Like the tech people, for instance. That's a group. There are some things that are a bit of a belief system in that group, for instance, but for any group. Then we also have groups of friends, where there are thoughts that are more admissible than others. Things that you can say freely and others that you'd be maybe become uncomfortable saying. And then you have, you know, political groups, so many others. There's a lot of different kinds of beliefs. And finally, when there's a belief, there are often morals attached to it. For example, things of the order of this is good, this is bad. And then, if you adopt them, it acts as a filter. When you listen to things, when you analyze life, when you analyze a lot of things, when you mix it with being in favor or against something, it helps you to decide whether you agree or disagree with an idea. And then there are the times when we think. And when we think, this is not coming from the outside. It rather comes from inside oneself. That's just about every time you realize that you're a little weighted by a belief, a kind of automatic reflex, thought reflex. And that in reality, your first thought, the first one you had, may not be that well thought out. If you ask yourself that question again, you might actually see things differently. And this, it has to do with ethics. Well, if you want to see the difference between morality and ethics, well, let's say it's a very complex issue and not everyone agrees on how to define it exactly, but I'll just, you know, throw out a definition that can be discussed later if you want. Morality in general is rather perceived as being something that is of the order of what we should or shouldn't do. And ethics, to put it simply, is more about the guidelines that we ourselves have chosen to take as references in our lives. It's the values that we stand for, that guide us on a path, saying, you know, those are my limits and this is how I choose to conduct my life. So it's a real effort. And what I propose you is that the next time you hear someone speak on a topic about emerging technologies, for instance, that you'll do that essential thing to make sure that what the person says, even in a very convinced manner, maybe being very assertive, very convincing, that it's just not a matter of conviction. Try to ascertain whether there's an ideology behind it, if there are values guiding the speech, or guiding even the analytical approach. I propose that we do this together with some examples, by studying the speeches of a few people who are kind of famous. We'll do that about speeches that concern tech subjects. Well, I'd like to start with a kind of speech that might be the one that sparks me the most. It's all those speeches that are really negative and even outright presenting us with a landscape in the future that is apocalyptic regarding to tech, I mean. So for instance, Elon Musk, so the CEO of SpaceX, Tesla, and so many amazing adventures like Neuralink, OpenAI, well, not anymore OpenAI, but, you know, great, great mind, great inventor, super smart guy. But to be honest, I failed to share his values. So let's hear what he says about artificial intelligence. He says that is the greatest threat to the existence of our civilization. Well, that's something, right? And that's especially surprising, given that the man is so well versed into the most innovative technologies that there are. Well, in France, there is another person who's Laurent Alexandre. He's an entrepreneur and a surgeon. And he says that artificial intelligence is going to produce more revolutionary people. In France, we had a movement that was called the Yellow Vests that, yeah, was pretty much trying to question the status quo on the left side. That Laurent Alexandre has been expressing himself for many years, and gradually the general public in France is getting to know him, and he's seeking to wake up citizens and policymakers. Globally, what he's saying is that France is a digital dwarf, which is totally true, and that against the United States and China, France is getting rolled, and that there will be disastrous social consequences out of that. Elon Musk and Laurent Alexandre have something in common in their speeches. There are people who believe that there are risks associated with the development of new technologies. And that is the surprising part, because, you know, maybe I was being a little naive, but I was thinking that once you start considering that new technologies represent a risk, maybe one stance to take is to say that we should take it slowly, maybe even back away from tech. Or at least try to think about it, instead of always trying to innovate more and more, since it's raising more and more ethical questions. But not at all. What surprised me most was that those people, what they propose is even more technology. So for instance, to respond to the problem of global warming, Elon Musk proposed is that if we don't change the way we treat our biosphere, we'd consider lives on other planets. Okay, I'm going to quote him. He says, "We want to make sure there's enough of a seed of human civilization somewhere else to bring it back and shorten the length of the Dark Ages." Whoa, really? Okay, so I was pretty surprised, because, you know, going to Mars is far from anecdotal. Even though there are amazing improvements and advances year after year, well, there's still a series of technological challenges that are very, very far from being solved. And it's extremely enthusiastic, but it's far from being resolved. So finally, seeing this response to global warming, that there should be more technology, well, that wasn't intuitively my first answer, so that surprised me. And Laurent Alexandre gives an explanation that I find very interesting to their way of seeing the world. He explained their point of view, his and the ones of other people like them, to be maybe due to the fact that we tend to project on the world our own psychoanalytic structure, that we just can't help doing that. And I'm going to quote Laurent Alexandre, but I think other people having the same way of viewing the world might pretty much say the same. He says, "I know I have a castration anxiety. Spontaneously, I have Hollywood-like anxieties. Like, you know, it's terrible, we're all going to die. And at the same time, I have a megalomaniacal structure. So the exponentials attract me intellectually and please me." Okay, let's think about this together. Let's try to see where these speeches are coming from. What do they believe in? What are their ideologies? What can you think when you hear someone say those things? Or when you read these in the media or see in a video on social media? Well, one thing that we can say that is objective is that there are entrepreneurs, investors, tech investors. They see the glass rather empty, right? Well, we could even say that if there's something that can happen, they'll just assume the worst. They're also megalomaniacal. Well, I feel that their view on the world is that there are only a few men, a handful of humans, who can change the destiny of mankind. A bit like in the movies. It challenges them. They like it. And I understand that. You know, they need to be attracted to a challenge that is worthy of their abilities, because they're very bright people, so they need something that pulls them, that for the moment gives them meaning in their lives, and that makes them move forward. That's probably why they're attracted to that idea of exponentials. But what I hear, the most interesting thing is their personal ideology, their conviction that technology is a solution. It's a solution to the world's problems. For them, humans are sufficiently creative and always ready to create more technological progress. And so there's no need to worry about global warming. We'll find a solution. At worst, if we don't find a solution, there's a plan B. There are people on Mars that we'll bring back. Obviously, that's an opinion that is particular. It's pretty much on the extreme side of the kind of opinions you can have on the subject. And there are people who don't agree with them, as you can imagine. And in particular, you may have followed the little altercation between Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg of social networks a few years ago. In interviews, you had Mark Zuckerberg saying quite the opposite. He was saying that he thought that recalcitrant people, people who are saying, you know, those negative things, that are trying to sell a doomsday scenario, are, in a way, he said, pretty irresponsible. According to him, in 5 to 20 years, artificial intelligence will bring about improvements in our lives. And you can see that he clearly sees the glass as full. Another person, Ray Kurzweil, the director of engineering at Google and the Singularity University co-founder, says that humanity has all the ingredients needed to meet the world's greatest challenges and create abundance for all. And the Singularity University program offers to prepare people to seize exponential opportunities. There's that exponential idea again. For those people, this idea of a world that's not really finished. In fact, that vision that we have of Earth that could be a space with finiteness is kind of swept away. Those men consider that the human being, thanks to his capacities, brushes off the boundaries of our human condition. They are very optimistic. Ray Kurzweil is a transhumanist guru, and he brushes off the limits of our humanity. As for other transhumanists, illness, death, those are problems that need to be solved. Well, there are the people who have more nuanced views than those two extremes of positivism and negativism. In-betweeners. For example, Thomas Pesquet, the astronaut and researcher who was on the International Space Station for 6 months, tells us that we can see from the ISS the harmful effects of human activity. And from there, high up, we soon realize that the Earth is very fragile. I find it an interesting comment because almost all astronauts say that coming back to Earth, as if taking a step back was a way to realize Earth's fragility. Rather than, you know, when you're in the middle of it, you don't necessarily see it. Even though we know about climate change, many people, yeah, seem to not see it. And so what he says is that, and I quote him, "We hope to take men and women to Mars, but for study purposes, not colonization. I'm not comfortable with the idea of a plan B, because it's taking our part of responsibility away." Well, I find that to be an interesting point of view because, you know, he's a scientist, a researcher. I have a way of seeing astronauts as a bit of superheroes. They're athletic, they're smart, they're incredibly resistant to stress. Socially, they're very strong, they can live together in an enclosed area. And he's someone who's very legitimate. He really knows all about what's going on Mars. He's an astronaut who works with NASA, ESA. And all he's telling us is that this whole Plan B thing, well, he sees it as a kind of an easy way out in the end. That instead of wondering what we could do in here now, we're projecting ourselves into what we could do, sending people away, bringing people back. In any case, it's not the objective of people doing research. And there's also Étienne Klein. He's a French physicist and philosopher of science, the director of the Research Laboratory on Matter Sciences at the Atomic Energy Commission. And he says that the role of the scientist is sometimes to stop people from dreaming about impossible scenarios. He reminds us that we have physical laws that we know, and that we should use those laws as a basis for thinking about the future, and not imagine that we're going to discover new ones. Because we can't build the future of our societies on bets that are too risky. We have to take into account what we know that is solid in our thinking, that is true, that is proved scientifically. That's an interesting point of view. So for those men, those in-betweeners, what's essential is that we take responsibility. We try to find solutions today with what we know, what's solid, what's scientifically proven. And these people are not people who are dreamless. These are people who also dream big, dream large when it comes to building solutions. What they advise, what they feel, is that you have to base them on solid knowledge and not utopias. Things we want to believe in, but which today lack feasibility. So when you hear all those people, what do you think? Well, maybe it's safe to say that these are only men, white, over 40. Among the people who are known to the general public, there are not so many women. Generally speaking, we hear more from male experts than women, especially in the field of emerging technologies. Well, and about black people, luckily there was an African-American at the top of the NASA, the big boss. Actually, was so lucky that I could discuss with him. Well, generally speaking, we hear more about those male experts than women, but when we listen to all these people, I don't know about you, but overall, it helps me only a little bit because you hear a little bit of everything and it's opposite. And it's not that easy to know how to position ourselves because many of the things that those people say make sense. They all seem to be right. In any case, they're very convincing. And they're intelligent people, so they make rational speeches. They're good speakers. They present compelling cases. So now, how do we ourselves form our own opinions based on that? Well, that's where your ethics will help you. As I was telling earlier, there are a lot of people talking. So we can do a first screening by doing what we did earlier. Taking a step back from what they're saying and ask, where are these speeches coming from? Do those people have personal interests to defend? Why are they pushing us in one direction? Are they trying to scare us because maybe they want to promote solutions that are even more technologically advanced? Things that they would sell? Are they trying to scare us so that we could finance these kinds of projects? We can imagine every scenario, and we're not really going to have an answer. But just taking a step back from what we are hearing is the first step. And the second, it's your ethics. Everyone have different values. Maybe we can group together by affinity, but in the end, even if we have common values, based on which ones come first, we're not going to make the same choices. We're not going to see the same things the same way. For instance, if you're a liberal, it's going to give your opinion a hue. If you're a humanist and you think humans should come first before all else, it might be other values that will come first. You'll have a different opinion compared to your neighbors. Ultimately, it's a bit like choosing coffee. You know, when you choose coffee, you start by looking at the various coffee beans options like Robusta, Arabica, decaf. Next thing, you might look into the provenance, the supply chain, the sustainability. Is it organic fair trade? Were people reasonably paid? How was it transported? We also have our little preferences in the type of filter. You know, the machine we use to make it that perfect cup of coffee that matches our particular taste. We all have our personal preferences. Well, actually, we follow exactly the same process to build our opinion. The first step is to analyze the options. Listen to the various experts and stay open to all opinions. Then, we try to take a step back and have a critical mind. We try to understand where speeches come from, their ideological assumptions. And finally, we filter with our own values. And in the end, we're going to have as many opinions as there are people. I have a question for you now. While I was speaking, did you say to yourself that exactly like the people I've been talking about, I was speaking from somewhere, from my own perspective? Well, of course, I have my own viewpoint, my own biases, like you. And it's essential to have this lucidity, to know that when you say something, you're influenced. We're all influenced by our culture, our education, the group of people around us that can tell each other what is frowned upon. In fact, when we want to debate and defend an opinion we have, it's essential to know why we think what we think. And on the other hand, to take advantage from a debate, if we don't want to merely be talking, then listening to someone else, and in the end, having everyone stay in their initial position, we can try doing it another way. We could be ready to let ourselves be convinced by others. You know, if the other person has good arguments, why not be ready to change our opinion a little? And when I tell you this, I'm not telling you that you must build a dogma, your own ideology, that you need to find what your truth is. Not at all. On the contrary. Because the opinion you make today will evolve. And it must evolve. Because we live today in an era where new technologies every day are emerging. Every day research advances. Incredible things are happening. Well, I don't know about you, but I find it super exciting to live in these days. And it comes from the fact that every advancement, every great use that can be found, such as the sensor for Kathy, can have a flip side when you think about it on a large scale, at the societal level. It brings up a lot of questions. And we have the right to have an opinion that is nuanced in relation to that. We don't have to be 100% in favor of a subject. We can be for something with nuances. Or we can be against, but agreeing that in some cases it might work. So in today's life, tomorrow, in 10 years, 20 years, in our lifetime, our opinions will evolve. And there's one thing. I don't know if you realize it, but in my opinion, and it's really strong, I believe that all those people who know a lot about tech, you know, in comparison to, we're among those who know what they're talking about. Well, we at least have an opinion on this subject anyway. Well, I don't know about you, but my mother asks my opinion every time she has a question about tech. She asks me what I think about it. For instance, during the Cambridge Analytica scandal, when Mark Zuckerberg testified before the US Congress, she asked me, "Are you going to close your Facebook account?" Maybe this question also came up around you. Maybe people also asked you what you thought about it, what your opinion was. Or maybe they didn't ask anything directly, but people were listening to what you had to say about all this. When you speak, when you make a decision, by your example, you might influence people. And that's a hell of a responsibility. Because for the people around you, Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg don't have as much weight as you do. Between Mark and me, there's no debate. My mother will refer to my opinion. Why? Because our entourage knows us. They have already done a little bit of the work to understand us. That first step about understanding assumptions, they trust us. They might also think that you're a good person. They might share your values. And that's a big responsibility. And we must live up to that responsibility. And in order to do so, the only way is to take the time to think about what our opinion is, with our own values, our ethics.